Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Whack the Mole by Maggie March. Narrated by Hannah Cabell. Chapter 1. The thing about being a human lie detector is that people will surprise you with the strangest fabrications at the oddest times. Take right now. Rusty Newton, one of Whispering Bay's finest, is looking me straight in the eye. And he's just told me a whopper. I shift my weight from foot to foot. I've been standing behind this counter for over 3 hours without a break. It's the busiest morning we've had all week. And it's been a record-breaking week here at the Bistro by the Beach, the cafe I co-own along with my friend Sarah Powers. Probably because I've become a bit of a celebrity. A small-town celebrity, to be sure. But when you're responsible for nabbing one of America's most sought-after serial killers, people want to come and gawk at you. Not that I mind the gawking. It's been terrific for business. You want how many muffins again? I ask Rusty.
12.
He pulls a piece of paper from the front pocket of his uniform shirt. Rusty Newton is in his mid-40s and has been a cop here in town forever. He's super sweet. But not the brightest bulb on the force.
And 5 lattes, 4 turkey sandwiches, a tub of Sarah's mac and cheese, and 6 oatmeal raisin cookies.
And this is for the crew back at the police station?
Who else would I be getting such a big order for?
Not for the Whispering Bay Police Department, that's for sure. For one thing, Zeke Grant, the chief of police, has already been in this morning for his coffee and muffin fix. And Cindy, the department's receptionist, is on a diet. She hasn't caught so much as a whiff of one of my muffins in weeks. But that's not what gave Rusty away. It's the little hairs on the back of my neck. Whenever I hear a lie, they automatically start to tingle. Being able to sniff out lies is a gift I've had ever since I was old enough to tell a lie myself. A gift I never appreciated until a few days ago, when it helped me solve the murder of Abby Delgado, a prominent member of the Sunshine Ghost Society, a local club that claims to commune with the dead. But that's another story. I punch Rusty's order into the computer. Is this all to go? Before he can answer, another one of Whispering Bay's finest comes up to the counter. Officer Travis Fontaine is the newest member of the force, and he looks almost as yummy as one of my double chocolate chip muffins. I wish I could say it was the uniform, but it's not. Travis is 6'3" with dark blonde hair and fierce green eyes. He spent 8 years on the Dallas police force before recently moving here to live near his dad, a retired homicide detective, all of which makes Travis a good son. He's also arrogant and the easiest person I've ever read in my life. Not because his face gives anything away. On the contrary, Travis has a poker face that could make him a bundle in Vegas. It's just that for some reason, where he's concerned, my spidey sense is on ultra alert. Rusty just put in quite an order, I say. Is the police department having a party? Travis doesn't so much as twitch.
No party, just a bunch of hungry cops.
Right. I have to admit, this charade of theirs has me intrigued. What do they want with all this food? It'll take a few minutes to get that order together.
No problem.
Travis leans into the counter.
How's your head?
Still sore, but I'll live, thanks. My head met up with the backside of a frying pan a few days ago. I still shudder whenever I think about how close I came to becoming the Angel of Death's latest victim. Good thing my dog Paco was there to save me. Speaking of Paco, he has his own unique form of spidey sense because he runs up to me like he knows I'm thinking about him. Hey, little guy. I inherited the adorable little mutt when I solved the murder of his former owner, Susan Van Dyke. His name used to be Cornelius, but that was way too stuffy, so he's Paco now. The members of the Sunshine Ghost Society think he's a ghost whisperer, which, of course, is silly, But like I said, he's special. It's almost like he can understand what the humans around him are saying. I'm allergic to dogs with fur, but after all we've been through, there's no way I'm giving him up. So I'm on medication to keep from itching. It's not supposed to make me drowsy, but it still does sometimes. I consider it a small price to pay for keeping him. I live in the apartment above the cafe, and Paco spends his days going up and down the stairs between our home and the bistro's dining area. The customers love his cute antics, and Sarah finds him adorable as well. Paco runs around to the other side of the counter to greet Travis.
Hey, boy.
Travis squats down to scratch him behind the ears. According to Lainey Miller, the manager of the Whispering Bay Animal Shelter, Travis is on the lookout for a dog. I try to imagine what breed would go best with his personality. Probably a Rottweiler. Or a pit bull. Travis rises to his full height and gives Rusty a side look that makes the older cop slink away. It also makes me nervous. I haven't known Travis long, but like I said, I have a pretty good read on him. He hasn't asked me out yet, but I have a sinking feeling that's about to change.
Are you busy Friday night?
Oh boy. I've been expecting this ever since Travis told me that he's now become a muffin man. To most people, that wouldn't mean a thing. But besides my lie-detecting skills, I also make the best muffins in Whispering Bay. Not that I would say that, but everyone else does, so who am I to argue with them? Friday night is when Will and I watch America's Most Vicious Criminals. Will Cunningham is my best friend. I've been secretly in love with him ever since my 7th birthday party, when he saved me from a pack of rabid squirrels. We started our Friday night TV and pizza tradition when I moved back to town after graduating from culinary school, and I wouldn't miss it for anything in the world. Since moving to town, Travis and Will have become friends too. They even play in the same basketball league. If Travis suspects that I have feelings for Will, he doesn't let on.
So how about tonight, then?
How about tonight what? I hate playing dumb, but I have no experience when it comes to fending guys off.
How about we grab something to eat?
Tonight's my book club. He spears me with a look that makes me squirm.
I guess that's better than telling me you have to wash your hair.
No, really. I got invited to Betty Jean's book club. And I promised to bring muffins. Apparently, there's a big waiting list to join, so I didn't dare refuse. Betty Jean Collins is a regular customer here at the bistro, and a real character. She's a prominent member of the Gray Flamingos, a local senior citizens activist group. She's also the 80-year-old female equivalent of a hound dog. No man under the age of 60 is safe from her. At the mention of Betty Jean, Travis breaks down and grins. When he smiles like that, his eyes become even greener. He really is quite attractive. But he knows it, so that spoils it a little.
So you're busy tonight and tomorrow. How about Saturday night?
This guy doesn't give up, does he? I try my hardest to think of a reason to turn him down. But there isn't one. I could maybe possibly be free Saturday night. Did I really just say that?
What would it take to make that a definitely free?
I'm about to answer when... Lucy! Travis and I whip around to see Brittany Kelly rush into the cafe. Brittany Kelly and I have a weird history. We both grew up in Whispering Bay and attended school together. Our relationship, however, got off on the wrong foot way back in kindergarten when she lied about stealing a brand new set of paintbrushes. Being a naive 5-year-old, I told the teacher about Brittany's lie, which got me labeled as a tattletale and earned me Brittany's disdain for the next 12 years. At least, that's how I saw the situation. Brittany viewed things differently. Apparently, all this time she's wanted to be my friend. At least, that's what she says now. She works for the Whispering Bay Chamber of Commerce, a job her rich daddy helped her nab, and came up with our city's tagline, Whispering Bay, the safest city in America. Brittany spots Travis, and her brown eyes go wide. I have brown eyes, too, but Brittany's have an extra oomph to them.
Hello, Travis.
Her voice sounds breathy and strangely seductive. How does she do that? Hello, Brittany. Travis smiles down at her, but it's more a patient smile than an encouraging one. I admit I'm intrigued that he doesn't seem to be as wowed by Brittany as every other male on the planet. She wets her bottom lip.
I hope you don't mind, but I need to speak to Lucy. It's super important.
Travis gives me a meaningful look.
We'll finish this conversation later.
He politely joins Rusty at the far end of the counter to give us privacy. Hey, Brittany, what's up? I ask like I'm happy to see her. Which, for once, I am. If she hadn't interrupted us, I would have said yes to Travis, which would have been a big mistake. According to Cindy, in the short time Travis has been in town, women have been showing up at police headquarters in droves, hoping to get a chance to speak to him. I have absolutely no intention of becoming a member of the Travis Fontaine fan club. Plus, if Will finds out I went out with Travis, which he would because nothing in this town stays a secret, it might ruin any chance I have with him. Am I attracted to Travis? Yes. Am I interested in any sort of long-term relationship with him? That would be a resounding no. Brittany makes a pained face.
I just spoke to Tara, and she says that the film crew will be here first thing Monday morning. I knew it would be fast, but I'm kind of freaking out here. Relax, it will all be fine. Fine? This is the cooking channel. We only get one chance to impress them. We absolutely have to be picked for their new show.
Battle of the Beach Eats. Great name, huh? Is the cooking channel's newest hit show. It's a reality TV competition that pits restaurants in the same town against one another until one by one, each restaurant gets eliminated and the last one standing is crowned the winner. Which means if we get selected, the Bistro by the Beach will be competing with the other eateries in Whispering Bay, including the Harbor House, which is owned by Brittany's daddy. The prize money is $25,000, which I could certainly use. Tara, the show's producer, is scheduled to come with her film crew to get some local footage. According to Brittany, if they like what they see, then we're a shoo-in. No worries, I say. Sarah and I are planning to come in on Sunday to make sure everything looks spick and span. If Whispering Bay isn't picked to be on Battle of the Beach Eats, it won't be the bistro's fault. Brittany looks me over like she's my commanding officer, and I'm a grunt lining up for inspection.
Good to hear. So, about Paco, do you think it's a good idea to have him running around the cafe all day? I mean, I love him to death, but what if Tara gets wigged out by it? Not everyone is a dog person, Lucy.
She did not just go there. Paco stays. End of story. Brittany sighs dramatically.
My intel says that it's down to us and some city named Catfish Cove about 100 miles east of here. Apparently, they're super environmentally correct, so we have to do everything we can to convince Tara that Whispering Bay is the wholesome American beach town they're looking for. I've ordered the city's maintenance department to trim all the trees on Main Street, and I've got wreaths coming in for all the businesses to hang on their front doors, and... well, I kind of went over budget, so we simply have to get picked.
Wreaths for all the businesses? Yikes. I can't imagine how much that might have cost.
You know, Lucy, we have so much more to talk about. Maybe we can do lunch again.
Brittany and I had lunch yesterday like regular girlfriends. It wasn't as horrible as I imagined, but I don't want a repeat anytime soon either.
Okay, sure.
She pulls out her planner.
When?
Maybe after the film crew does their thing? I think we'll both be pretty busy until then.
Right. You're so smart, Lucy. Call me tomorrow so we can make plans.
She blows me a kiss on her way out. I slump against the counter. Talking to Brittany for 5 minutes is almost as exhausting as spending the morning serving customers.
Sarah comes out from the kitchen and hands me 2 big bags. Funny, I don't remember the police department ever placing such a large order.
Neither do I. Rusty pays in cash, then he and Travis take the bags and leave.
Phew, says Sarah. I'm glad things are slowing down some. Want to take a breather? You haven't sat down all morning. Through the glass pane window, I watch Rusty and Travis get into their squad car, and my spidey sense slaps me up the side of the head. Or maybe it's residual ache from the frying pan incident. Whatever. But something tells me to follow them. And if I've learned anything in the past week, it's that I need to listen to myself. Do you mind if I take an early lunch break? No problem. Jill and I can handle things for a bit. Thanks. I grab a sweater and Paco's leash. He happily jumps into the passenger seat of my VW Beetle. Since Travis and Rusty are in a squad car, it's not hard to spot them. I stay in the right-hand lane, 3 cars behind, going slow but not too slow because I want to keep up. The Whispering Bay Police Station is next door to City Hall, but instead of turning into the parking lot, Travis keeps on driving. I knew they were up to something. Paco sticks his head out the window. Get back in, I urge, in case either Travis or Rusty are looking. The last thing I want is for one of them to spot me. The squad car takes a right into Dolphin Isles, a new residential community of cookie-cutter homes. Whispering Bay is a coastal town of about 10,000 year-long residents, mostly young families and retirees. But there's also a substantial vacation and snowbird crowd that rent homes in this subdivision. Travis parks the squad car on the side of the road. I stay half a block down, shielding my car behind a big palm tree. I'm confident they can't see me. Paco barks like he wants to ask a question. Shh, I warn. We're trying to stay incognito. He freezes like he understands, which is actually pretty cute. I glance back at the squad car, expecting Travis or Rusty or both of them to get out, but nothing happens. Could they be on a stakeout? My heart speeds up at the thought. But that makes no sense. All that food for just the two of them? I make a mental note to buy myself a pair of binoculars when I notice a jogger coming toward them. Male, mid-30s, lean build, navy blue hoodie. He slows down and approaches the squad car. Travis hands him the 2 bags of food through the car window, then the man takes off jogging in the opposite direction. After a couple of minutes, Travis and Rusty drive away. I make sure they're gone, then I follow the jogger. Chapter 2. I've never followed anyone before, but it's actually kind of fun. No wonder Harriet the Spy was one of my favorite movies as a kid, was always writing down observations in that little journal of hers. Besides the binoculars, I should also probably pick up a couple of notebooks, just in case. The jogger goes up 3 streets and into a 1-story stucco home on the edge of a cul-de-sac. The garage door is closed, and the driveway is empty. What do you think that was about? I ask Paco. He turns his head the way dogs do in that quizzical manner that looks so adorable. Since I'm not as prepared as Harriet, I scribble down the address on the back of a Tiny's pizza coupon and slip it into my tote. After a couple of minutes of nothing happening, I drive back to the bistro. What did I just witness? On the surface, it all looks pretty benign. Except Rusty lied about the food, which I already knew. But why? Who is this mysterious jogger? And why the sneaky food handoff? the rest of the workday goes by quickly. The bistro stops serving food at 2 p.m., and luckily, Sarah has cleanup duty today because tonight is my first book club meeting, and with everything that's happened in the past week, I haven't had time to read the book. Confession, I don't even have a copy of the book. Since Betty Jean has already warned me that she can always tell when someone is fudging it, I need to take care of this situation ASAP. The last thing I want is to be kicked out of the book club on my first night. I download J.W. Quicksilver's newest espionage thriller onto my Kindle. Book club starts in less than 5 hours, so I won't have time to finish it. But I figure that if I skip right to all the big scenes, that would be the ones involving either death or sex, no one will be the wiser. When Betty Jean first invited me to her book club, I made excuses not to join. I'm the only member who isn't eligible for the AARP, but when you're facing death in the form of a frying pan to the head, your life flashes before you in ways you've never imagined. I need to work on becoming a better person, which means trying new things. I read for an hour straight before I get up and stretch. Betty Jean was right. This stuff is ridiculously addicting. Too many explosions and assassinations for my taste, but the sex scenes have totally managed to grab my attention. I mean, do people really do this stuff? They must, or someone wouldn't have written it, right? I grab my laptop and Google this mysterious J.W. Quicksilver, which is about as phony a pen name as you can get. The bio on his website shows a picture of an old-fashioned typewriter instead of an author photo, which means that not only is J.W. not using his real name, he doesn't want anyone to know who he is. Betty Jean thinks he uses a pen name because he has a top-secret government job, which would explain why he knows so much about the spy business. But I think it's because of the sex scenes. I'd bet my apple-walnut-cream-cheese muffin recipe that J.W. is a bald, middle-aged schoolteacher living in the Bible Belt with a wife and 6 kids. His books have won awards, and his latest, our book club selection, Assassin's Honor, has been on the bestseller list for over a month now. I wonder what J.W. would think about Blue Hoodie Guy. Who is he? And why does he need so much food? I fish out the Tiny's pizza coupon from my sweater pocket and type the address in my computer. It comes up on a list of vacation rentals, and the broker for the listing is Kitty Pappas. Kitty is a total sweetheart and Whispering Bay royalty. She's a founding member of the Bunko Babes, a local group that plays bunko once a week. Everyone in town knows her and her husband, Steve. I give her a call. Hey, Kitty. It's Lucy McGuffin. Lucy, I've been thinking of you. Kitty wants to know all about my near-death experience at the hands of a crazy sociopath. I can't blame her, since nothing like that has ever happened in Whispering Bay before, but I'm getting tired of telling the same story over and over. Roger Van Cleve, who co-owns the Whispering Bay Gazette, has been after me for an interview. I think I'll take him up on it. That way I can just refer people to the article. After I give Kitty enough details to satisfy her, I ask her about the property in Dolphin Isles. Are you looking for a place to rent? I thought you loved living over the bistro. Oh, it's not for me. It's for a friend. I'll be happy to give your friend the information on the house. Currently, it's leased out, but it's a short-term rental. Just till the end of the month. Oh, really? I say, trying to sound casual. A snowbird? Hardly. The couple who rented the place are in their 30s. Honeymooners, I think. I can't show you the house since it's occupied, but if you give me your friend's email address, I can send them pictures and any information they might need. Oh, thanks. I don't have her email address on me, but I'll pass the info along. Yikes. After solving the mystery behind Abby Delgado's death, I promised myself I wouldn't lie anymore. But here I am, doing just that.
We say our goodbyes. After Kitty's phone call, I'm more confused than ever. Why on earth are Rusty and Travis getting food for a couple of honeymooners?
Mommy is going out for a while, I tell Paco, who's laid out on the couch, because being the bistro's mascot is apparently hard work. Be a good boy.
He yawns and goes back to sleep. The library doesn't close for a couple of hours, so I still have time to swing by before book club starts at 7. Since Will is the head librarian and I'm his best friend, everyone at the library knows me. Sally Reynolds, one of the newer media specialists, waves to me from the reference desk. She's from somewhere down in South Florida, and since moving to town a couple of weeks ago, she's come to the bistro at least 3 times to get one of my muffins, which means Sally has excellent taste.
Hey, Lucy. Will is in his office.
I stop by her desk to admire her new hair color. Sally switches hair color the way I change t-shirts. Today, her chin-length hair is bright pink, a look she can totally rock because she has that kind of face. She's wearing a black sweatshirt with the words, "Winter is coming." Besides a love of muffins, we have a couple of other things in common. We both like wearing shirts with quirky sayings, and we're both huge Game of Thrones fans.
"Nice," she says, pointing to my "You Ain't Seen Muffin Yet" t-shirt.
"Thanks. Say, have you ever heard of an author named J.W. Quicksilver?"
"I'm a librarian, Lucy. Of course I've heard of him."
Funny, because when I mentioned him to Will last week, he seemed clueless. Sally rolls her eyes.
"Will's a great guy, but he's a bit of a book snob."
"Tell me about it."
Will's preference for the classics over popular fiction is well known. I'm surprised that he stoops low enough to watch America's Most Vicious Criminals.
"You wouldn't happen to have a copy of his latest book, Assassin's Honor? I'm supposed to read it for Betty Jean's book club." "Betty Jean Collins?" Sally playfully shivers. "I might be new to town, but that's a name that makes me want to hide behind my desk. She comes in every morning demanding to know if we've gotten any new books."
She tisks. "Total book hog."
"That's her. Do you have a copy of the book?"
"Sorry, it's a new release, so we're all out. We have a waiting list if you want to put your name on it."
"Book club is tonight, but that's okay. I have it on my Kindle."
Sally plugs her ears with her fingers.
"La la la la, can't hear you."
I laugh.
"Sorry. I hate to think that one day there might not be any print books left in the world."
She sighs.
"So, have you started reading Assassin's Honor? What do you think of it?"
"Honestly, it's pretty addicting." She smiles impishly.
"Have you gotten to chapter 14 yet?"
My cheeks go hot. Betty Jean warned me about this chapter already. I kind of skipped ahead to it.
"Whew!"
Sally fans herself with her hand.
"That J.W. Quicksilver sure can write a sex scene. It makes you wonder what he's like in real life."
Will pokes his head out his office door.
"Lucy, I thought I heard your voice. Come on in."
Sally and I both startle like we've been caught with our hands in the muffin jar. I head into Will's office, where I make myself at home. Will's office is basically a glorified cubicle with 4 walls, but it's private and cozy. The walls are covered with pictures of family and friends, including one of Will and my brother Sebastian when they graduated high school. There's also one of me in an apron standing behind the counter on the day that Sarah and I officially became owners of the bistro. I'm grinning like a fool, probably because it was one of the happiest days of my life.
"How's your head?" he asks.
"Better."
"Good. I'm glad you came by. Saves me a phone call. I have to cancel tomorrow night."
"Why? What's going on?"
"Will never cancels our..."
Sample complete. Ready to continue?